Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about this two-loop and Higgs-field space geometry stuff. And this is there's results in this paper this week. It finally is done. It took a long time to finish, but it's finally out. And I'm going to talk, this is like, there's a string invitation to talk in a couple weeks, which is mostly going to be about the field space geometry stuff. So I'm not going to talk about that in great detail. There's some cool theoretical stuff there. But I'm going to talk to you about it in passing in terms of how it motivated us to do some stuff at two loops a certain way, because of you'll see the consistency issues that are showing up in this approach. So there's basically two different approaches to effective field theory that has been adopted for LHC and other collider stuff for many, many years. One is you can just say quick and dirty, right? So it's like, you know, basically throw down a couple of operators and just basically roughly see what happens in terms of deviations or lack of deviations. Just have a rough idea of what's going on. You can think of it like just a sensitivity study, a way of saying, is there something weird happening here? And then there's another more systematic, hardcore approach, which is what I'm really going to talk about and where these calculations sit, which is what's actually been developing the last 10 years. So in that case, you have to be super careful for reasons I'll explain. You put in all the operators, you systematically improve everything, and you really calculate a lot. And it's a lot more intense than the sort of slapdash sort of thing that was happening around the time of the Higgs discovery. But that's how experiment is evolving now. And that's basically what's starting to. This is a paper from Atlas from last year. And these, I'll explain this in some detail. This is a glu-glu Higgs constraint, and there's a Higgs to gamma-gamma constraint in here. And it's combining Higgs processes with electric precision data processes, and they're actually giving sensitivity now. So if you know.
So this is from lab electroweak.
Yeah, so I worked with them on this as an associate. So this is actually electroweak precision data combined with Higgs data, which is most of the strong constraints here. I'll get into this in more detail. But the point is, if you know experiment, if you know the way these people work in the big experiments, there's like 1,000 people experiments. So they're like a battleship. Okay, so to get them moving at all is a lot of work. But once they move, they just keep going in a certain direction. And so sometimes they should actually turn. It's really, really hard to turn them. But they just keep going. And so it's good that they've started. And basically the point of this work is that this will not stop now. You cannot stop this machine. It's just going to keep going forward. It's going to get better and better over time. And essentially what we're doing is we're getting ahead of them, filling the water in ahead of the battleship with these calculations so it doesn't crash into a wall. That's basically the way you can think of this work and why it has to happen. Okay, so let's talk about this in a little bit of detail. Now there's this I tried to slow myself down because I knew there would be some younger people to talk about some basics. And I'm going to use the blackboard too to really try and slow myself down to talk about some basics. And then only at the end will we start doing two-loop stuff, which is kind of, you know, detail-oriented. But you'll hopefully appreciate at that point why it's actually happening.
Michael,
Yep.
So like LHC collaborations, they are not yet. You didn't actually turn that right.
Sorry?
LHC collaborations.
No, that was Atlas. Yeah, that was Atlas. Yeah,
no,
like there's some gray hair there for this. So that like I worked with them internally for about 2 years to make this happen. This is this. If you know how these people are, if you know how difficult it is to get anything like this out the door, trust me, that was a nightmare. It's not Atlas and CMS yet. That needs to happen, and then they'll be even better. But in both cases, everything's moving in the right direction. The battleships are now moving, and it's going to happen. It's happening already, as you'll see. Okay? So the basics, though, is why are we doing this, and why are we thinking this way? I want to motivate this and explain this so that it actually kind of makes sense why we're doing these higher-order calculations. So what we're doing is we're incorporating in the discovery of the Higgs, Higgs to gamma-gamma on the left, Higgs to four-lepton on the right. And because we actually see this resonance bump around the time of the discovery, we now have a very strong experimental support of thinking that that degree of freedom is embedded in this scalar doublet with 4 degrees of freedom. So we know the leading Lagrangian we can perturb around, right? Just the standard model. And we're incorporating that information into how we study the data. And we can just study the data in just the standard model assumption. And that's fine. But essentially, what we're doing is we're going beyond that. We're doing a more robust interpretation of the data. So we incorporate that we have a Higgs-like scalar in what we're actually writing down and what we're actually using to study the data. But we also incorporate the fact that in many, many cases, people have looked for resonance bumps in many, many searches. Okay? So they come up with a model, they argue that the model's a good idea, they convince experimentalists to spend some time on it, and then if they don't find the resonance bump or the kinematic edge that they're looking for, that turns into a constraint. And what these are a whole set of those constraints for a whole bunch of different models. So these constraints, the only thing you need to see visually is these bands of constraint. So this is like they didn't find what they were looking for in terms of resonance bumps, and the bands of constraint are pushed out to TV scale, QTV scales, okay? But down here is the mass scale, including that discovered scalar of the standard model states in that gray region. And then the idea of this approach is that we don't actually know beyond what we know what's going on up here. And what we would like to do is we would like to study the data not just under the standard model assumption, but we would like to study the data in a way which allows the standard model to break down at higher energies. So there could be something happening in this QTV region, and we haven't excluded that yet. So if that's the case, you're actually working in a different theory. So you actually basically have to build into the study of the data that the standard model can break down at higher energies, like most people think is going to happen. And you basically then need to reformulate how you're studying the data and a whole bunch of different experimental observables to basically systematically do this program. This is going from the, you know, quick and dirty EFT to like the hardcore systematic approach. And there's a lot of stuff that you need to just take into account. Now, why can we do this? We can do this because we have a ratio of scales. Like this is, we're thinking about things in terms of new states and dynamics that's in the QTV region, but that is mass-wise much larger, and this is a log plot, than the scales that we know about in terms of the particles of the standard model. So this ratio of masses that we know about divided by masses that we don't know about is less than one, manifestly under the assumptions that we're adopting. Now that allows us to do a lot. It allows us to actually make a lot of progress, and it reorients the way we think about the data, which is actually what's been going on in the collaborations. There's something that's important here as well, is that also if we think this way and we actually do this, we all add the local contact operators and study systematically what's going on, it actually is also, we should be a little bit humble that we're not actually that good of, well, we're not that good at thinking of complex models that could happen in the UV with some complex symmetry breaking structure, lots of degrees of freedom. And even if we can think of those models, they're not easy to sell to our colleagues without any experimental evidence. So we tend to think of simplified versions of things that can happen in the UV. Unless we have a great symmetry principle underlying our thinking. And if we do this sort of thing correctly, if we do this sort of approach systematically, we can also basically conserve the possibility that something complicated will happen eventually, and we'll have the data interpreted in a way that's consistent with that complicated possibilities in the UV. All of these things have to decouple, they have to get small as the mass scales get big, but it actually preserves many possibilities that we don't even necessarily think of now. So that's what we're doing, is we're basically upgrading this understanding of the data in terms of this sort of approach. So the way it works, just to remind you of the basics, is that you have a resonance, an intermediate resonance, and essentially that can be something that's heavy, and we're not exciting it on shell. So S is less than M squared, we don't excite it on shell, and then we have theorems in our hands, like the decoupling theorems of these papers, which tells us that the dependence on the heavy mass scale is simplified. You can Taylor expand. And you should think of it that it's just what is essentially going on, it's just the uncertainty principle. So essentially, heavy things that exist that are coupled to the standard model, even if they're heavy, it's not that they don't affect the standard model measurements at all. It's not like you completely remove the coupling to the standard model. It's still there. It's just a small effect. And the effect is that you can think of it as them virtually popping into existence and then dying, where they're not being excited on shell. And then they will exist for basically a length of time proportional to the inverse mass, because the energy scale is set by the mass scale of the heavy state, and for a certain distance, which is proportional to the inverse mass. So this is why things get localized into local contact operators. It's just the uncertainty principle that we're doing the perturbations in terms of all these local interactions that we write down. Okay, and this is very general, and these sorts of general arguments apply for all sorts of new physics models, which is why essentially this works for any sort of new physics consistent with our assumptions. So you just get this sort of inverse heavy mass scale dependence. In the numerator, we get kinematic factors and possibly mass scales involved with standard model states, in like the top mass or the Higgs mass or V squared in general. And that's the SMEFT, just as the reminder introduction. So that leads to the standard model with all of these corrections written down with this inverse heavy mass scale dependence. And it can capture all sorts of UV models consistent with the very general statements that I've made so far. Okay? And I'm going to switch to talking about not a specific heavy UV model, but to like a cutoff scale in the EFT for the dimension full scale, because we want to capture all possible models at this stage. So that will be a cutoff scale where this effective field theory starts to break down, but we don't know what that is. We want to study the data agnostically where lambda can take on multiple different values. Okay, that's the basic idea here. And the unknowns here for different UV scenarios are the Wilson coefficient CI, which we don't know. We want to fit them from the data. And you just saw that they're starting to fit the constraints of them from the data.
Yeah, principle they can be different, right?
Sorry?
So the kind of scales are present different operators,
they can also be different sort for symmetry assumptions. So there's lots of stuff I'm suppressing here for length of time. This series has a beautiful structure in terms of the symmetry behavior of this series as well. Like this has involves lefton number violation, whereas this one doesn't necessarily involve lefton number violation. So the odd mass dimensions are different. There's a lot of stuff I'm suppressing, but there's still scales. There can be multiple scales, but we're just going to do the simple thing now and have a simple lambda, and then the different values of the Wilson coefficients can absorb these different things, okay? So what this does for us is it basically lets us think about the kinematic patterns of the standard model, the resonance features, and just we normalize them up and down, right? So gamma-gamma and for lepton decay again, if you're not introducing new kinematics and then the lambda squared, there's a v squared in the numerator, if it's that sort of correction, you just normalize this up or down, and you normalize this one up or down. Sometimes you can get a p squared from some operator connection, and that can actually change the shape of the curve kinematically, right? But all these things can happen, and we basically study the data agnostically, putting all of this together. That's what the experimentalists are now doing. And the key point is it's not bumps, okay? So they still do bump searches and bump hunts and all that sort of thing, but by thinking about just the normalization and shapes that they're actually seeing in the data more and more precisely, it's a very different experimental program. Okay. So hopefully that was very clear, and the basic sort of introductory statements are fine. Stop me at any time if it's unclear. Okay, so what you can do is you can just basically take the standard model and you can extend it with a model. And people, yeah?
Stupid question. Lepton number violation, I assume that
dimension 5.
Yeah, prioritize things that do not break lepton number.
Yeah, that's a dimension 5 versus dimension 6 thing.
Yeah.
So like the collider, they don't design experimental measurements which are sensitive to lepton number violation, except for dedicated experiments. So that's what concatenates out the dimension 5, and mostly it's the dimension 6 stuff that we do. So it's interesting. You can actually prove formally from hypercharge that the different mass dimension of the operators is associated with the global symmetry structure of the theory. This is something proven by Kobach and other people. It's kind of cool, actually. It's not a random thing that dimension 5 is lepton number violating. It actually follows from the... Yeah, it actually follows from the representations and what you can write down. It's cool. It's not a random thing. Yeah. So then also it's true at dimension 7, dimension 9. So it's interesting. Okay, so...
This is in a Kobach paper?
Yeah, I can show you. There's a bunch of them. My former student also did something cool with that, too, Helset. So what you can do... is you can ignore everything I said. This, you know, you can always do that, right? And what you can do is you can take the standard model and extend it with a model. This is what this plot is really doing, right? And you can do a tree-level calculation, or you can do a loop-level calculation if you're strong, or sometimes people very rarely do two loop calculations in a specific model, but you could, and you get some things, and then you could take that individual model and you can map it to these constraints. You could reinterpret these constraints, right? You can just do that, and that's fine, but what you'll notice if you do that iteratively is there's parts of the calculation which are the same every time, right? That's the IR physics that the EFT is capturing and organizing. And so it's much more efficient to think in the EFT to actually know that that IR physics, that universal physics is there, calculate it all for once, so you're not surprised by doing this model matching procedure over and over and over again. You know, save your time and just do it correctly once and for all. That's another reason that we're doing this sort of thing. Because it really organizes you to understand what should be universal and what is dependent upon UV assumptions, which are detailed, which you have to make. Okay, so that's good. All right, so hopefully that's straightforward. And now I'm gonna start trying to use the blackboard to try and make some of these points, because this gets subtle. So there's the W mass. So let's talk about the W mass. I think it's a good illustrative example. So this is the statement I'm gonna kind of flesh out a little bit. So once we're starting to not look for resonance bumps, but we're starting to look for deviations in this different way, shapes that are different than what you expect on the kinematic structures of the standard model, then you have to ask yourself the question, what do I need to measure to actually figure things out? Like, how are these fits working in the experiment? So the key point is that any one measurement is not enough, right? So if you have just one measurement, all you're gonna do is fix a Lagrangian parameter in the standard model and shift it perhaps from what you thought. It's a pattern of measurements that have to be made, and that pattern of measurements has to be systematically improved, which is what this talk is about, order by order in the expansions you're doing. So think about the W mass. Hopefully you can see this. So what is a W mass measurement and how it deviates from the experiment? Okay, so this plot is showing you that there's some expectation of the W mass, and then there's a deviation in one particular measurement that's a bit off. Others are consistent, but let's think about what it would mean if a deviation like this solidifies in the case of that W mass. So what they're doing is they're actually measuring just simply essentially this with a W, and it's a lepton neutrino, and it's QQ bar, it's the Tevatron. And that, even though you don't reproduce the resonance peak because of missing energy for the lepton, you can look at the transverse collision plane, and so essentially the collision, you can look in this direction and look at transverse variables. And then you have a kinematic feature which is like this, which is right at MW, something called the transverse W mass can be found in the data. And that's how they actually basically measure this sort of thing in that experiment. What this is the transverse lepton momentum and the transverse neutrino momentum and the cosine between these things. That's not what they actually see. What they see is actually a detector smooth version of this, but that's the kinematic feature that's in there that they're actually extracting. And they see something like this, okay? And when they say they deviate from the standard model expectation, they have a curve that they produce in a code that is produced, and then they basically measure something which is slightly different from the standard model expectation in the shape. And that's what these sorts of effects are in EFT, right? These sort of shape variation effects we're looking at. So you can ask yourself the question, how do they know the standard model expectation? All right, so the way they know the standard model expectation fundamentally is there's a code, it's called ResBose, that they run. But what they need is they need essentially G1, G2, and V, the VEV, and then some masses, or potentially the Yukawa couplings, if you have the VEV. And then these are numerically fixed, and they run perturbation theory in this code, and then they get the shape. And then they compare in a fit that they do to see what they get versus what they expect with measured values of these things. But when you're doing the EFT, the point I'm making to you with this global pattern of measurements is it's not just one measurement, right? So you could say this deviated from what you expected. So you extract a W mass here, and you can say, well, okay, I'm getting a deviation of the W mass. And I'm gonna start introducing a notation here I'm gonna use to organize the discussion, which is delta will always mean, this delta will mean something that is 1/λ². So this is like dimension 6 corrections. And if I give you a big delta, that's going to mean a 1/16π² correction. So you can say there's a shift in the W mass, which is going to be, if you work this out, some Wilson coefficient, some V²/λ², it's a series of these things. You can actually figure this sort of thing out, but it's just an expression you can work out. And you can say, well, we're finding a shift in the W mass. But it's not that simple, because you had your standard model expectation built in. So you had to fix these things from some other measurements. And the way you fix them from some other measurements, well, how do you get this stuff? Well, what you do essentially is you measure the Z mass at left, and that's actually a resonance peak, and that gives you MZ. And you know its relationship between these gauge couplings and the VEV, and so you actually use that as an input. But that's not enough. You also need to measure something else. And what you measure as well is you basically measure another thing about the W, muon decay, in the limit that P squared is much, much less than the W mass squared. So it's a local contact operator. And that gives you psi bar psi gamma with a P left, psi bar psi gamma with a P left, with a coefficient, and that coefficient is -2/βV². So if you have this measurement at low scales, very low scales, and you make this measurement, and this is combined with this, then you get two things. And to decouple the last thing, what you can do is you can just do the Thomson scattering. So you do some charged guy with a photon, and you go up P squared, very, very much less than the masses that are involved. And then this gives you alpha. Okay, if this gives you alpha at a low scale in this case, and you can choose if you want to run that alpha then through the hadronic resonance region and think about using alpha at MZ. But this is what you do fundamentally. And so when you see a deviation like this, and that gives you these things as numbers, okay? The hats mean they've turned into numbers. So you see the deviation like this, it could be that it's the mass shift, but it could also be that when you inferred this, or this, or this, there were some local contact operator effects there. And so these each get a delta that you can work out systematically at one loop order, right? Like just with the dimension 6 stuff. You can do loop corrections, you can do dimension 8 stuff. All of that happens, and then you get these sorts of things. And then these things, when you use your code, which under standard model assumption produces this curve, can mean that what you get deviating can be due to these effects, as opposed to just this effect. So what you have to do is measure a bunch of different things, track how these different shifts come in multiple observables, and figure out what's actually happening, and then get to the Wilson coefficients. Okay, so that's the meaning of this statement. that you need to do a global pattern of measurements. So hopefully that's clear. The good thing about all of this stuff is all of these deltas, they're actually with kinematic features of the standard model. So what appears in the numerator is a v-squared, okay, not the p-squared possibility. And that's good because we actually have a lot of calculational power related to v-squared over lambda-squared corrections.
So it's always the Higgs boson that enters there, at least in the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, in the stuff I'm talking about. So that's because for the input parameter, because they're the kinematic structures of the standard model and lower scale things. Other things you could measure have p-squareds.
Yeah.
But this is a very important subset of the corrections that we actually, I'll show you. This is where the geometry stuff comes in. Okay, so the stuff I'm talking about has the v-squared corrections. Okay, so hopefully this is all very straightforward. So we want to find deviations, map the pattern to the SMEFT, doing all of this stuff order by order, which is not a trivial thing, and then follow the pattern. Okay? So if we're not doing resonance searches, this is our burden, that we have to do all of this sort of thing. We have to do this all consistently and systematically, order by order. So it's a big effort. But the amazing thing is that we're actually making enormous progress. Okay, so here's an example of muon decay in just some detail in terms of Wilson coefficients, so you can see. So here's muon decay, this is the operator form that you get. You basically measure this thing, and then this maps to this guy in the standard model with possible loop corrections. And then this is the higher dimensional operator that can be there. You can also modify the coupling of the W to the fermions. They can be there as well. This whole thing is a delta GF, which they're actually incorporating in Atlas and CMS when they do these sorts of fits. Okay? That's just one example. All of them have things worked out. And so let me leave it at there and move on. So we want to then do this systematically and improve this order by order. Is there any questions so far? This is clear. Once you go away from resonance bumps, this is your burden. You have to basically start to do this sort of thing.
So there's no relation between the ones that grow with momentum and are these completely independent?
It's a very good question. So it is a very, very long answer. So there's two expansions. There's expansions in kinematics, and there's expansions in v squared over lambda squared, kinematics being p squared over lambda squared.
Yeah.
Now, both of those, order by order, appear in the operator basis. But what's really cool, which I'm going to get to, is that you can actually think systematically about the v squared corrections in terms of field space geometry, because they're all associated with the VEV. So they are a part of an operator basis, and you can choose different bases to move and relate things by equation of motion, but there's always v squared over lambda squared corrections. And they can always be packed up into geometric understanding. And that's really cool because we actually understand that geometry really well now.
I guess the question I'm asking is slightly different.
Yeah?
I mean, could you have physics that only... So, could you have physics that only contribute to v squared over lambda squared and not the other?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Like,
You can get corrections v squared over lambda squared when you have additional scalar sectors and that sort of thing very easily as you're coupling to the Higgs, not necessarily introducing other Lorentz connections. So usually when you start to couple things with other spins, you start to get more, you know, momentum as well as v squared corrections,
yeah.
And you get both. When you simplify down to like scalar extensions, it tends to be more v squared. You'll always tend to, you know, you're going to have to choose your operator basis. And so there's going to be some stuff you'll shift around.
Yeah.
But the point is you can understand geometrically always, no matter what operator basis you choose.
So
let me show you a little bit more detail on this. Good. So yeah.
So, the question about data analysis. So, I mean, you get a huge number of parameters.
It's actually not that bad related to her question. So that's another great thing about what I'm talking about here. Sorry to interrupt. Maybe you should go on and I can answer.
Yeah.
No, if it's not that huge, then that's perhaps okay. But no, I mean,
it's not that huge, no.
Yeah, it's not that huge. I mean, how would they do that? Monte Carlo market chain or what?
Exactly. That's why, 100%. That's why we focus so much on these things, which are the ones where things are under control. And it is actually a wonderful, wonderful thing that they're as under control as well as they are. And they're under control for very good reasons. It's the symmetry structure of dressing Higgs field emissions with the completeness relations that makes it so it's a better series. Let me show you. Well, no, there's still going to be, you know, tens of parameters. But with the data sets that we have now, we can do this. And the PDF fitter groups are already involved. And like there is issues of closure and completeness and all that sort of stuff. But it's not that it's thousands. That's the misperception that's out there, which is wrong, and wrong for good reasons. It's really closed form answers can be done, and I'll show you how this works. So that's the key question, and it's really much, much better than you think. So let me try and convince you of that. This is what's happening now, and this is a leading order fit. Okay, so they do this leading perturbation stuff with CHG and gamma-gammas in there. And these are the things that are really sensitive in terms of the Higgs properties. These are these two Higgs measurements that are showing up. And electric precision data, we need to make it more precise. These particular Higgs measurements we need to make more precise. And that's where I'm getting to by the end of the talk, the two-loop improvement of glu-glu and gamma-gamma. But also we need to talk about all of these delta corrections, right? Like dimension 8 and all that sort of stuff, because it can be bigger or the same size as loops. Okay, so we need essentially, related to your point, professional large-scale fitter groups that are very good at Monte Carlo closure tests to get involved, which they are. And we also need to be very, very careful to make sure we put the water in front of the battleship correctly in terms of the calculations that are ready when they advance in precision with experiment, for glu-glu Higgs and Higgs to gamma-gamma particularly. And also electric precision data. So this is the stuff that I've been focused on for the last little bit. And not just me, there's other groups. Like there's a paper today. And what they're doing today, there's this paper by Sally Dawson, and she's doing delta, these cross-term corrections for electric precision data. There's one 2 days ago from the group at Durham and other people, Ben Pekiek and friends, doing these sorts of corrections as well. There's a paper of delta to the fourth by Harlander today, okay? So there's lots of people working on this higher order stuff.
But higher order, what does that gain you? I mean...
We'll get to it, yeah. But I'm just saying that people are doing a lot of this stuff, and we're pushing beyond the leading order analysis now. Let me show you the formulas.
It's not clear.
It's not clear, but hopefully it will become so. Okay, so this is getting to your other point, and your point, which is, so this is the thought process. Okay, so you want to do these things, and you want to do loop corrections to these things, and you also want to worry about things like this. Like, what about the next order? This should be a 2. Right? What about all that stuff? And they're extra Vs, right? They're extra V squareds. So you start to think about it and you're like, wait, so that's like an operator with 2 VeV insertions. And then when I do the next order, this is 2 VeV insertions, so it's dimension 8. I could think about also 2 VeV insertions going here, modifying things. And you start to write down all this stuff. And at some point, hopefully, you clue in, you think, wait, doesn't that awful lot look like the propagation of the Z in the Higgs background? And doesn't it look like the interactions of the Z to the fermion fields in the Higgs background space? And that's exactly the right thought to have, because that's exactly what's happening. We're basically generalizing with all these VeV insertions and symmetry generators the interactions of the standard model to Higgs manifolds that are there. There's a bunch of them that are important. And so once you have that thought, you start to say, well, what can I do to compactify all of these things together to actually make these calculations easier? And you actually need 3 things in particular for what I'm going to talk about. There's this one, and it's essentially the Higgs propagator generalized to a background field, Higgs propagation. You need this one, which is the generalized Yang-Mills term, and this is WA field strength, where A here is 1, 2, 3, 4, and that's the W1, W2, W3, and then the B field. So this is a generalized Yang-Mills term with cross terms as well. And you need one other thing, which is kappa, H dagger H, and this is for G mu nu. So with these things in hand, you can actually do a lot, and a lot in terms of input parameter corrections. And so you start to think of these matrices. These things, you can compactify all the higher dimensional operators that give extra VEVs, and you put them in here with symmetry generator insertions, and then rather wonderfully, related to both of your questions, this happens, which is actually in the general Hilbert series, and this is independent of the operator basis. So you look and you say, well, in this HIJ thing that I've written down, how many parameters are there at dimension 6? There's 2. And you say, oh, well, that's bad. Maybe at dimension 8 there's 5,000. But no, at dimension 8, there's just 2 extra parameters too, and it's H dagger H times what you already wrote down. And at dimension 10, it's the same. There's only 2. It's an extra H dagger H times what you wrote down, and so on and so forth. So this is general, and you can actually prove that this happens from the completeness relations, because what you're doing is you're putting down a bunch of Higgs fields, generators, and having 2 external indices, and you're saying, how many times can I do that contraction? And essentially, you have generator, generator, completeness relations, reducing the complexity. And that's what's going on here, which leads to this saturating to a constant complexity in these functions. So we actually can write these things down in closed form when we actually have all of these guys as well as the gluon one. So that gives us calculational power exactly where we need it for these things that get precise for these sort of pattern tests of the standard model.
So curvature in this
Well, when you start to do higher endpoint corrections, the curvature shows up. That's part of the whole story, which is really interesting. So like the Riemann curvature tensor.
Yeah, yeah.
So from these are so what you've correctly identified is that these are really metrics in field interaction spaces. And from them, you can derive the Riemann curvature tensor that corresponds to them. And when you do higher endpoint interactions with four indices, you get the Riemann curvature, your Riemann tensors directly. So all of that stuff happens. What I'm talking about here is the things for these important phenomenological connections, which is restricted to like up to three-point interactions. But you need to extend this further for the geometries that are present for higher endpoint interactions. But the important point is that for these sorts of things that get measured very precisely, you build them up around the standard model resonance structures. And resonances come from three-point interactions. And so basically, you have the calculational power you need to study the things that are getting precisely experimentally. Okay. So it does show up, but it shows up, you know, in addition to this story. Okay, but this is the calculational power that we need and we have.
You say 2-point, you say 2-point interaction, like 4-point interaction. Yeah, you have to do that.
Yeah, 4-point interactions exist. Yeah, no, for sure. This is up to 3 points, but you do get those other things. But then again, if you're going to have a 4-point interaction in the standard model that gets a resonant contribution, even if you're not going on shell, like for here, here's an example, right? So this, you don't actually produce, you don't actually like identify the actual resonance of the W, right? But the fact that the W was resonant for the experimental measurement that you do dominates the phase space population with that spike I showed you. And it basically dominates the experimental feature that you actually measure. So whenever you have things that are even our 4-point interactions that go through standard model resonances, there's a relative dominance of phase space by the ratio of the width of the standard model particle compared to the other scales that pumps up its effect on the experimental measurement so that this is what we need for the precision that we're actually after right now. But those other things exist. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it does matter. We need it more, but we'll stick with what we have here and build, and then we'll get there. Okay, so yeah, we do need it, but you'll see with what I'm calculating now that we can do the job with these guys. Okay, so it's specific to low endpoint interactions, which are specifically the things that are being measured very precisely.
Okay, you are saying the dimension 8, this kind of quasi-resonance is dominate.
It's not just, I'm saying a stronger statement than that, not just dimension 8, even higher order. Yeah, yeah. Resonance spikes really matter. They're big, you know? The widths of the standard model particles are small. If the widths were not very small for the standard model particles, if we didn't have a weakly coupled gauge theory, the story would be different. But this is what we have, what we're perturbing around. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this in some detail so you can see. These two guys, here's an example up to dimension 6. The ones in the diagonal are the standard model. That's the square root of this metric. And then you get C tildes, which are V squared over lambda, because it's all about the V squareds. V squared over lambda squared times some Wilson coefficients. And here's the other one for the generalized Yang-Mills term. And what's good about this is it's really organizing the physics the right way. So you get the standard model amplitude. You get something to do with kinematics or hard scales like V squared. That's an expectation value of operators for some observable. And you get numbers. And this is cool because the numbers are multiplying different kinematic features, different kinematic structures. And if you say to yourself, well, I could in principle perform an experiment to isolate these individual bits because I can, you know, cut different ways in phase space, then you can identify these individual little bits. And if you can identify the individual little bits, then this individual piece should be Fielber definition invariant.
So
and that's the case. Yeah, so it's packed in there. It's a function of the Wilson coefficients. But because it's Fielber definition invariant in the path integral, what it means is it has to express itself in the experimental perturbation through something that is a characterization of these spaces, which is independent of how you coordinatize the space, how you Fielber define the space, and how you move things like you were asking about from dimension 6 and move it around. So it has to be properties of these geometric spaces which are field reduction invariants. So that's like curvature, projections, and these sorts of things. So they have to be properties that are independent of how you redefine things. And that's why you get combinations of Wilson coefficients multiplying these expectation values. And that's where the basis independence comes from. Okay, so it has to be geometric. That's the physics that's here, so that's why we're identifying it and using it. Is this clear? Good. Okay, so here's an example. Okay, this is a way to write geometrically the glue-glue-Higgs connection and Higgs-to-gamma connection, and not just have the dimension 6 corrections, but have the dimension 8, 10, 24, 2000, 2 million, whatever you want, all in closed form, one line. It's really cool that you can do this. And it's simply the canonical normalization, that's a Velbein, really, of the Higgs field. You vary one of these connections to pull out the Higgs field, and you put the kinematics in. That's it. You do the same thing with the case of photons. You have to worry about rotating to the mass eigenstate basis. That's why it's a little more complicated. And that's also why there's couplings appearing. Those couplings themselves have a geometric expression. They're a generalization of the electric charge, which has to do with this geometry and the Yang-Mills term, because it changes how you rotate from weak to mass eigenstate fields. And this is also a generalization of the Weinberg angle, which has to do with geometry, which you can write down in closed form. But the thing is, this solves the answer at not just dimension 6, but dimension 8, 10, 12, whatever you want, in the V squared over lambda squared expansion. So then we're done, in the sense. We have to do that for the input parameters as well, but we can do that too. We've done all of that. And then you're focused on the loops because that's the hard bit now to really clean up. Okay? So this is the whole delta N expansion being written down in a nice closed form using geometry. So now loops. Okay, I'm switching now to loops. Are there any questions on the field space? This is just in passing. I'm going to talk more about it in a couple weeks. There's lots of cool questions and stuff to talk about there, but we have limited time. So, okay.
No, no, I want to see how we go from that to data.
Yeah.
I guess what you're talking.
You're getting there. Yeah, okay. So we're going towards data. Okay, so now we've added a bunch of the perturbations. People work on the cross terms in the perturbations, and we worry about the loop effects now. Okay, so what do we need to worry about? Well, let's think about this process, okay? So now in the standard model, well, maybe I'll use this blackboard. In the case of the standard model, glue-glue-Higgs and Higgs-to-gamma-gamma is a loop at tree level, right? And of course, this is top-dominated. This is a little less top-dominated, but gamma-gamma. And these calculations are just known at leading order. They're known at, you know, one loop, two loop order. In the standard model, people calculate like crazy. They go to third order and they do all sorts of stuff. And so we're adding contact operator perturbations to this with this geometric formulation like this, which is just an operator form, and then the tower of those, delta plus delta squared and all that sort of thing. And similarly for here, we're doing that with delta plus delta squared and that sort of thing. So what do we actually get, and why do we have to do loops? Well, these guys are loops, right? So then what is the amplitudes that you're getting here? So you're getting amplitudes just schematically, which are the amplitude in the standard model. Now remember, I use a big delta for loop effects. So this one I'll give a big delta. Then this is a calculation here, which goes back a long time ago, which is just a leading delta, for example, in glue-glue-Higgs. Okay? And so you just take that and you square it. And you get things which are delta squared, a standard model, cross terms of delta, delta GGH for a standard model with a real, but don't worry about that, and then delta squared GGH. And then if you start to improve things, if you start to add the delta squared piece of the standard model and the higher order effects here, you get all these sorts of cross terms. So you can just take this and you can add an operator form here or here or wherever you want, and that gives you a delta-delta contribution that you then add in here. And as soon as you add something like that, this guy for the perturbations, if you interfere with the standard model, will scale as delta A standard model, delta for the EFT stuff, delta, so that's overall something that's delta squared and then dimension 6. So two-loop dimension 6 interference. And that's why we're doing two-loop calculations, because as soon as you do that, there's also just the delta squared A standard model times the leading guy, which is the same order. Okay, so that's why we need to do these sorts of things. As soon as we start to systematically improve the cross terms and we go up in the expansions, we're calculationally burdened to do all these sorts of corrections, just to basically make sure we get everything in good shape for the experimental community. So that's the motivation of the rest of this talk. I better go a little bit quickly. So this is the leading order stuff done many years ago. It's the standard model for the decay rate and also for the cross-section. And they used actually a two-loop result, which has this 11 over 4 alpha. This is just a partial two-loop matching. It's not the full two-loop result. I'll show you the full two-loop result in a minute. But this was included. And this is just something you can just do. Many, many years ago, you could do this. It's straightforward. And we're systematically improving this sort of thing.
Right, let's understand, going to next order. So, well, as long as we don't see any kind of hyperlevel the constraints at the leading order, dimension 6 operator, why would we go to dimension 8?
Very good question. The reason is there's a number of reasons. One is that you want to know how wrong you are in terms of the higher order terms that you're neglecting. Another thing is that you can have matching patterns. Glu-glu-Higgs is a really good example compared to Higgs to gamma-gamma. So you can actually say to yourself, well, if you think about this sort of thing, if you start to basically do these sorts of corrections, and you say, wait, the new physics I'm interested in some useful way, has a loop expansion as well for Glu-glu-Higgs. That's something that can happen. And then this thing scales as delta. That reorders the expansion a lot, because it's a 16 pi squared. If it's not as small a loop factor as the standard model, but it's still a loop suppression, then you still have to worry about all the other terms, because it reorders what you're interested in. So if you want to robustly conclude from the data, many cases with many different Wilson coefficient hierarchies as well, then you have to basically do these sorts of systematic improvements. And there can be times in which things surprise you. So a specific example is for Higgs to gamma-gamma, you can prove that the dimension 6 Wilson coefficients that go in there, under the assumption of a weakly coupled or normalizable UV completion with like a perturbative matching, they're loop suppressed. But when you actually do the dimension 8 guy, you don't have that loop suppression factor anymore. So even though you've gone up one order, not having a loop factor is a big deal. And so you need to worry about that sort of thing. And that comes about in a very simple way you can think about as like a triplet model coupled to the gamma gamma. Like I can show you. It's really easy to figure out this sort of thing. Gamma glu glu is different. Glu glu is interesting. Mark and I were talking about this a bit at Caltech. It might be protected like at all orders, but it's a subtle question once you go. Well, just because color. but it's not that simple for the reasons you were asking about of shifting things around in the so it's a subtle question, probably, but we're not probably. But it's under debate. But anyways, probably. But anyways, that's why you do these higher order things. Okay, so Glu-glu-Higgs, let's get there. Higgs to gamma-gamma, this sort of thing as well. Operator insertions, we just want to improve them. And as I emphasized to you, you might say, well, in 17 years, you've gone to one higher order in the loop expansion and one higher order in the dimension full expansion for the operators. You might say, well, that's not much. But remember, we have to loop improve and dimensionally, little delta improve everything, right? So that's a big effort, because you actually, if you want to systematically do it, you have to do all the inputs and the way you make these predictions, as well as the explicit operator stuff. So it's like there's a huge effort that has to go into that. So I don't think it's that bad, actually. And I'll show you why I don't think it's that bad, because I know like some of the details here, which are cool. So one thing is you have to formulate the theories. These input parameters are scattered at different mass scales. And you actually have multiple different theories. Like you have the SMEFT, you have the standard model, and then you have the case where you integrate out the Higgs and the top, and the W, and the Z, which is the low energy effective theory called the left. It's a pun because it's the leftover stuff once you get rid of the interesting stuff. And you need to formulate that theory too. You need to renormalize those theories. And then you need to do one loop matchings between those theories. And this is a big enterprise that has to be done. So that's done. It happened. There's a normalization. And this is a cool, so like this is a friend of mine, Peter Stoffer, who's a professor now at Zurich. He's Swiss, so I try and promote his stuff because he's Swiss, so he just kind of calmly calculates and waits to be appreciated, amazing things. This is a small subset of what these guys did, and Wouter Denkens is also someone I know well. And so they did the matching at one loop between the SMEFT and the left, the whole thing, as an EFT. It's amazing, like it's awesome what these guys did, and it actually feeds into some of these input parameter improvements. So there's a huge effort being done here, and this is what they did. One part of what they did. They did all this sort of stuff, and they loop improved that operator I was talking about for the muon decay. Okay, so this is the coefficient at one loop for the correction of the operator, with all of the standard model mass scales appearing. This is something calculable in the EFT. And then there's also, in both the SMEFT and the LEFT, QED, so it cancels in the matching. So then you have to add back for the experimental sensitivity of the photon loop, which is very simple. And that goes back to Kalin in 68, actually. It's cute. It's this really nice answer. So you get this coefficient now, had this correction, dimension 6. We know the whole tower. And we also have these guys working out things like this loop correction and the photon correction. Okay, so this is all being sorted out systematically, which is just cool. So the way they were able to do this is also related to the field space geometry, which is, I should speed up, one thing that I just wanted to emphasize. They used our gauge fixing approach because when you have the operators around and you just basically want to clean up what's going on, and you think about this sort of, there's these background fields, you probably would think, well, maybe we should gauge fix in the background field space as well. Maybe that gives us nicer ward identities and organizes the calculational subparts better. That's exactly what happens. And that's how we can check their results too. So we derived a lot of ward identities and like internal consistency checks of what those guys did looking, you know, cross groups. And by using these field space geometries and the perturbative calculations as well, that also allowed us to be sure that their results are correct, or at least cross-check a lot of it. Because things are getting complicated now. You want to have internal cross-checks. Okay, so I really don't want to go over. So there's a lot of internal cross-checks. Let me skip over this sort of thing. Like, it gives you ward identities, and it gives you things like the finite terms you can check between different groups. It's all very great. You can see that tadpole cancellations cancel between the groups. Do people know what tadpoles are? Okay, does everyone know what tadpoles are? Okay, good. Because like tadpoles, I don't know. I just like sometimes people like they don't want to know because they're awful, right? So the tadpoles are really terrible because they actually cause a lot of gauge dependence issues and issues in terms of expanding around the VEV or the one loop improvement of the VEV. And they use the same tadpole scheme as us, so we can see cancellations working. And you can even do the tadpole at all orders in the SMEFT expansion. That's something a former postdoc did. So the field space geometry stuff feeds in and it lets us do all these checks and they work. I don't want to go over, let's not worry about this. This is the sort of thing that you get for two-loop improving Higgs to gamma-gamma and what you actually get, like what you're asking about. So you get these sorts of answers, right? So this little bit, so there's three different input parameter schemes here. There's another subtlety.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Yeah. So with this field space geometry, you can use something like a graph in maths.
That's exactly what we're doing. That is what I mean by it. So I didn't want to get into the detail, but like I'm obsessed with the background field method. It's great with this approach. And that's part of the reason we had to work so hard on the QCD, which I hopefully we'll get to. because we wanted to put it into the background field method, but the standard model calculations are not in the background field method. And that's ugh. So we had to fix that. So we did. But I'll get to that in 1 second. So I'm just trying to show you that we produce these sorts of numbers, we hand them to the experimentalists in a code, and then it's not just in one input parameter scheme. You can choose different sets of things as inputs. And you actually get different answers. You can see the numbers differ. There's three different input parameter schemes here. So what they need to do is measure enough things that that scheme dependence damps out as well. So this will be like a long-term effort of what they're doing, but this is how things are going. That's gamma gamma. The numbers are known, experiment is happy. And we can do lots of different things with this result, but for brevity of time, we can talk about it later if you want. So let me talk about the glue-glue part. Oh, just to give you an idea of how this breaks up. So the stuff in red was the tree level interference or the loop improved dimension 6 operator stuff interfering with the leading order result. This is the self-square stuff or the input parameter corrections and then the direct and operator insertion corrections in yellow. And then there's the dimension 8 stuff. It's this lonely guy interfering with the standard model. So we actually know all these terms now. So this used to say is, and now it says was. That took about 8 months of work. So this is the glue-glue Higgs improvement. So this is something I just want to summarize for you without too many technical details. So we made a run at this calculation about a year and a half ago, and we got a bit frustrated for the reasons related to what you were asking. It's not in the background field method, the standard model result. We want to combine it with all these higher order corrections, which are dependent and formulated in a background field independent way. So you want to have the perturbative and non-perturbative expansions be consistent, the operator expansions and the loop expansion. So you need, so like that's a problem. So we want consistency. We don't want scheme dependence, which you saw, three different schemes, different numbers. We don't want scheme dependence to be the same order as the perturbations we're after. So we need to consistently uniformly calculate this stuff. So This means that we have to do some work on what's in the literature. And there's also another issue, which is the two-loop stuff. The two-loop stuff in particular is not in the background field method. And so what we were able to do a year and a half ago is look at the one-loop insertion of the standard model and the one-loop sort of matrix element dress stuff. And then we punted on the two-loop standard model stuff because like this was just like, well, how do we make it background field method? It's not clear. And but those are both the same order as I was emphasizing earlier. That's the same order, so we need to include them both. Okay, this will be a quick two-loop discussion. They're the same. That's the sort of beautiful thing that comes about after a lot of technical work, and then you sit down and you find that they're the same, and then you find a really simple reason why they're the same. It's the universal IR physics is the same with local contact operators. So like you can just take this guy, do this rescaling in terms of the two-loop guy descending a loop order, taking the MT goes to infinity limit, and you can do an anti-rescaling on the other term, and then it turns into this other guy. And the other IR contributions that need to cancel the poles, there's only one of those other IR contributions around, which you'll see, so it had to be the same. But it's up to a factor of two. That's how the IR cancellation is being split. So it's good. It's actually a nice thing to see and to like understand, but you know, it's the sort of thing that's a bit of a detail. Okay, we're gonna be into two-loop land now, but luckily there's only a couple minutes, so we won't suffer too much. But this is like standing on the shoulders of giants, and in this case it's Babbis. I don't know, he's pretty tall. So we're standing on his shoulders. But
that's
pretty high up. So we're getting a little, you know, the oxygen is getting deprived, but the point is we need to modify the results as well because of the background field method issue for the consistency. But he does this sort of thing where he produces these two-loop results, and what we were worried about in particular, this is a two-loop, this is a leading order result plus a two-loop correction. The leading order result, what we worry about is the following for changing from the way they did the renormalization to the background field method. He produces these things, the subloops of the top have an epsilon series, okay? So if you have epsilons in the numerator, then epsilons in the denominator from renormalization, how you do the renormalization differently, the epsilons cancel and you get finite term differences. So we are worried about the finite term differences that would be present in the calculation due to his use of a different renormalization approach when we combine with this other stuff that we can calculate. So we need to do the surgery here to basically change it over so that's consistent renormalization schemes. So there is a two-loop matching part of the answer, which goes back like 17 years, and you can find it in Babbis's answer, and it's this 11 over 4. But again, there's these epsilon terms that they calculate, which are known, and you have to worry about the renormalization change for the epsilons canceling for the finite terms being shifted around. So that's why we're worried. And we're also, we can see that just looking at the answer, the two-loop is not a good approximation, just the matching contribution. This is why in glue-glue-Higgs production, just in the standard model, you just don't get a good answer until you go like next and next and next leading order. The same thing happens here in the EFT perturbative expansion. So this is the renormalization that they do. They do this renormalization where they normalize alpha S in an on-shell scheme and the wave function normalization. These terms cancel, and they left over with a beta naught pole. And this is why we got stymied, and other people were stymied in the literature, because that beta naught pole is there, and it needs to be there for the IR cancellation that you know has to happen in terms of the pole structure so you get a finite answer. So it looks like this thing, which is not background field method, is actually like required in the way the calculation is being done in the standard model. But how can that be? You obviously should be able to choose the scheme any way you want. This condition holds in the case of the background field method, which means this totally cancels. So this pole that you know needs to be there to cancel some IR needs to come from somewhere else. And it comes from the local contact operator renormalization if you do things carefully, which is the same factor. It's not that big of a surprise maybe, but you have to dig it out of the results. So that actually is how one way you modify, but then you basically can track how the finite terms will cancel and change, and we have to go through the calculation to see the details. So this is the sort of thing you get at intermediate steps. If there's Taylor Swift fans, these are IR problems. These are all IR poles, and that beta naught pole is the one you have to worry about that has to be introduced no matter how you calculate, and the background field method does introduce it. And then there's these logs of these finite terms coming from the epsilon series I was emphasizing. You have to be worried about going through the calculation and how those all change. There's a universal IR dipole thing that's happening, Catani-Seymour, that they use, and they have to cancel the residual epsilon poles here after all the renormalization against this process. This is what happens in the standard model and happens in the EFT as well. And I'm gonna finish right now, don't worry. And then this is what you get from this other calculation. You get this sort of pole structure. Now you'll notice that there's no beta naught here, but you get these distributions. And these distributions are endpoint singularities that you're regulating for soft and collinear divergences. you have to basically do a little bit of work to reorder these distribution functions in a certain way. And there's something interesting that happens. You fundamentally realize you have to introduce an ultra Parisi counterterm proportional to the Wilson coefficient. So this needs to happen for consistency to reduce all the divergences out. And that means that you actually have to do, they're already doing this, the PDF fitters are already going in the direction of SMEFT PDF joint fits, but they need to do even further work because they actually need to incorporate these sorts of IR effects in the EFT to consistently fit the PDFs, because this counterterm structure needs to be around. And so then you get the beta knot pole rewriting the ulterior Parisi function a little bit. So it works at the end of the day. Technical details. There's a nice answer. Okay, this is the two loop interference result proportional to CHG. This two is the two different processes being exactly the same. And this is really kind of cool in closed form. And it's got exactly the distribution functions that you think should be there. The ulterior Parisi splitting is there. Nothing else. It's very similar to the standard model. There are log finite term differences like we were worried about. But it's a beautifully simple two loop answer. And that's it. That's actually what comes out of doing all of this sort of cross consistency stuff. And the distributions are here. They're not terribly interesting. What are the numbers? The numbers are the following. This. So when they do these fits at leading order, they have this leading number. And now all this other stuff can be calculated, and these are the operator definitions. And again, the way that what you're seeing organizes itself is interference at tree level with the standard model, interference at one loop with with operator insertions with the standard model, cross terms due to input parameter shifts, much less in the case of glu-glu Higgs compared to Higgs to gamma-gamma because you don't have the rotation to the mass eigenstate, so the input parameter stuff is less important, and the dimension 8 interference is there. Okay, so it's kind of just calculating, but this is how they use it. Like at the end of the day, intermediate steps of the calculation have all this field space geometry stuff built in and all this cross consistency, but at the end of the day, you fix the operator basis, which gives you a fixed expansion in terms of these geometric factors into Wilson coefficients, and then it interfaces with experiment. And that's essentially what we're doing, is we're letting these things be calculated so that when they move forward with precision, they're robustly able to interpret the data, even when there's hierarchies in the Wilson coefficients. And if they neglect all this stuff, now we know it, so we know roughly how bad it is, the approximation they're doing interfacing with the data.
How well can it be able to measure these coefficients?
It's a good question. So currently, they're at the level of like 10%-ish uncertainty. They project they're going to get down to a couple percent level uncertainty, but that depends upon statistical assumptions and that sort of thing, as well as the standard model calculations improving. But like another factor of 10, another order of magnitude seems to be built in. Well, things are improving better than they expect, but yeah, it'll be at least a factor of 10.
Yeah.
But that's just one observable. You have to look at other ones. And what we really need, as I tried to emphasize, we need combinations. So there's like the benefit of just maximizing the things that are really precise. And then it's also the effect of like thinking in terms of EFT and looking in terms of how we can maximize sensitivity by getting something else just a little more precise, but how it feeds into the global picture in a way that is actually quite useful. But these are the sorts of things that you can do. And these are the sorts of things that is being done.
So question, I mean,
yes.
Discovery.
Yes.
So what is the potential for discovering for these things? Given right now, they say roughly 10%.
Yeah.
So what is the potential for discovery for these coefficients in the next? Do you have a sense?
It's a hard question to answer.
Yeah.
Because it's a global statement. It's not just one sensitivity. That's the issue.
Can you speak to extended scalar sectors? Like the
Well, you can work out the matchings, so people do that as well. They work out the matchings, so there's papers recently doing this. You can do the matchings at dimension 8, dimension 6, and do loops corrections.
Yeah.
You can do all the matching effects. And what you find is that, as you expect, the sensitivity is into the few TV region. So you're not going to get sensitivity using these effects out to like 5 TV or something. It's just going to be too small. Essentially, it's just decoupling, unless you think of outrageously large Wilson coefficients, which don't make sense. So what it really does is it basically takes your dying off of the sensitivity of experiment because of resonance searches, and it extends it by a few TV. That's the reality of it. And it's kind of, I think it's intrinsically interesting too for the reasons we've discussed. There's kind of cool field theory showing up here, but that's really what you're getting. You're getting just a little more in terms of sensitivity for a couple TV.
So let's say, talk about discovery. So
yeah.
I'm not talking about finding a resident. So let's say we have.
Yeah, we're not. There's no resident. Well, this is what we need to do.
Is there room to see some 5-sigma effect?
Yeah, so that would be interesting to actually work out the sensitivity that you would require for 5-sigma. And that requires us to do these calculations. Because when you say 5-sigma, 5-sigma on what?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You're thinking of 5-sigma on probably the leading perturbation, but maybe not if you have that loop suppressed.
Let's say, what you showed that when you search is for past the TV, right?
Yeah.
So let's say that we have ancillary resonances at the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the 95% exclusion is at the TEV,
so
the question is how far can you push it in discovery, not exclusion.
No, that's a good question. And to answer the question, we're on our way to the answer. But you see, the problem is that, you know, it's not just one parameter. It's like there's a bunch of deviations that show up. You can actually prove that the only time that you basically get one operator is when there's extended scalar sectors. So there's going to be multiple operators, which means you have to combine measurements. So it's a hard question to answer because you can't just say it's just like one observable. Because if we were to say glu-glu Higgs production varies, and that's the discovery, well, you could say, well, what if the alpha S measurements are slightly off, right?
So we need to
basically do a global combined study. So it's a very hard question to answer until we actually get systematic improvement of this form for glu-glu Higgs, Higgs to gamma-gamma, and electric precision data all done in a consistent scheme. And we're close. So now we get these two. Electric precision data is in action. It's kind of happening. And so what you need to do, and this is why we argue a lot about these sorts of things, what you need to do is you need to basically say, well, what's a reasonable thing to do with refitting the data to basically when you neglect these higher order terms? So like, if you start to fit all the higher order stuff, even though the V-squared expansion is in better control, like I showed you, it's still a lot of stuff. But it's a lot of stuff with very small numerical coefficients. I mean, look at the hierarchy. There's like 10 to the 4s and then 1. Right? So obviously you can neglect some of this stuff, and you should to be consistent. But then you need to have a prescription to basically calculate this stuff and neglect the higher order things. So we argue about that recently, but the central limit theorem comes in to help us out, and essentially you have lots of different things varied around. And essentially that effort is ongoing, essentially, to turn it into a precise answer to your question. But it's like not something we can just say, it's like it's not that simple. Right?
No,
We need to dig.
I
care about everything. Will be nice. But even if it's like just hints, then how do we understand hints without this? This is the only way to understand it.
We could argue about the
forward backward asymmetry of the B at LEP. So it was a little over 3-sigma, then it went below. It still pulls. Does it mean anything? Probably not. I don't know. Maybe not. You know, it's the only way to really know is to basically systematically develop this and push the theoretical and experimental precision. That's all we can do, right?
I'm just saying that it would be nice.
It would be nice for me to be able to tell you that we'll get 10 sigma sigmas everywhere, but it's not like that.
Like some sort of I mean, honestly, I think it would make your case stronger if you had an example where you say, okay, you haven't seen anything now,
mm-hmm.
but doing this with a high limit, you can get 5-sigma discovery. Or,
yeah.
I mean, the moment you get 5-sigma, how will we have the discussion about building the next high energy thing?
Sure, but it'll be a model-dependent statement.
Yeah. I mean,
existence
proof.
Yeah, so that's ongoing as well.
Yeah.
So these things are being worked out. So the example I told you about gamma-gamma of going to dimension 8 versus dimension 6, that's an example. Because as soon as you get the fact that the Wilson coefficient pattern changes going from dimension 6 to dimension 8 by a loop factor, then it's hard to argue against the utility of improving things. Because you just get the sensitivity. So you could take that vector triplet model and very quickly turn it into the statement you want. And that particular observable. My motivation, I'm differently motivated. I like just understanding the EFT because there's like physics there in terms of the field space geometry, which is kind of cool. And I kind of find that to be field theory information that's interesting because it's teaching us how to think in terms of field space geometries. So like to even do So that's a general lesson that's actually true, which is independent of EFT, which has come out of the EFT. And if you want to then think about this stuff systematically, you want to say, well, what about the dimension 8 stuff? And you know, people have thought about renormalizing that and that sort of thing. And the way to do that, the only way they were able to actually make traction and progress was to actually go into the curve field space stuff again. The only way, as I try to emphasize, to do some of these calculations in a nice clean way was to do the field space geometry underlying stuff. So at the end of the day, you can think in terms of the model completions, which a lot of people are interested in. But I think the actual theory that we have, that's the actual theory that's there, that's corresponding to what we're actually measuring, with whatever sensitivity we get with other measurements, we should understand that as well as possible. Because it's like the same argument of like we should understand the standard model as well as possible.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And if you believe the standard model breaks, then we should understand this as well as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. It would, discovery would always be nice. But like, we're not going to argue against discovery. Yeah, I know. Yeah. 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 But I think if we hang our hats on only specific UV completions with discovery potential, we miss a lot of this physics.
No, I agree. I'm talking about specific. I wasn't thinking of
specific UV completion. Yeah.
I was thinking, okay, we are at the state where we don't have access to the UV completion to see it in the pool.
Right.
The question is, will we see a deviation in these recent coefficients at the 5 sigma level to claim, okay, there is new physics coming from somewhere, I don't know from where.
Yeah,
that's the question that...
Well, so you can turn it around, and you can easily see the case in terms of interpreting the W mass measurements. I mean, that happened instantaneously within weeks, right?
Yeah.
No, but then you have to argue against the experimental reality of the signal.
Exactly.
But the point is, if that happens, which happened...
Right?
Exactly. But we were ready with the understanding already. It was all built up. So we actually understood a lot of stuff instantaneously that we wouldn't have understood in models. We'd have to go and systematically look at the models. But I think that the sensitivity needs, so like order one, we need to push things below 10% level uncertainties. That's pretty clear, right? We need to get into the few percent region. And then we're cooking with gas. But that is how much we're going to cook, whether the burger will still kill you, I don't know. But we will then be in good shape. But whether we get to the full 1% and few percent in terms of the experimental uncertainties and the theoretical uncertainties, it's a challenge. Yeah.
So another question, still there are a lot of parameters in this.
There are, yeah.
So how does it kind of treat power or discovery power, how it compares with just the pure anomaly search, you know, like search for anomalous deviation from standard model?
The quick and dirty thing? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Well, like what Andrea Ruther and Rafael...
but I don't know what you mean.
To do some kind of machine learning and use some simple neural network.
Oh, what they tend to do is they tend to look at... there's a long answer. They tend to look at deviations in tails of distributions.
Well, not only tails, they actually can capture...
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
So let's thank Michael.
Okay.